With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City News Day. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning for your agriculture news. Today is Wednesday, July 18th. Coming up in today's show, we have more from the recent House Ag Committee hearing on technology and specialty crop production. But first, we start off this morning with Taylor Hillman.
Agnet West's parent company, Agnet Media, is proud to announce that we'll be hosting Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue at the largest grower trade show and seminar program in the country dedicated to citrus. Our sister company, Citrus Industry Magazine, has an annual Citrus Expo in Fort Myers, Florida, this year being held August 16th and 17th. Citrus Expo is proud to announce that U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue will be attending the first day of the show on Wednesday, August 16th, with U.S. Representative Tom Rooney. Perdue and Rooney are looking forward to walking the trade show floor and viewing the top-of-the-line products and services the Citrus Expo exhibitors have to offer. While on the trade show floor, Perdue and Rooney will have the opportunity to mingle with exhibitors and growers. Citrus Expo will provide Perdue and Rooney with a first-hand look at the challenges faced by the U.S. citrus industry, as well as the growers and industry leaders working to rise above those challenges. The 2017 Citrus Expo will be held August 16th and 17th at the Lee Civic Center in North Fort Myers, Florida. Registration is now open, and all pre-registered growers will be eligible for a chance to win a John Deere gun safe, courtesy of Everglades Equipment Group. To learn more about the Citrus Expo and to see the complete details of the seminar schedule, you can head to citrusexpo.net. That's citrusexpo.net. I'm Taylor Hillman for Agnet West.
What kind of protections are there for a farmer's electronic farm data? Gary Crawford looks into it.
New technologies allow farmers and their equipment to generate a lot of data on their farms, from agronomics to financial information, but as of now, there's no federal law protecting that data when farmers contract with data companies to store that information.
So it's very easy for somebody to lose protection for this data.
Roger Royce is a California lawyer who deals with this issue, and he told a House panel that right now the only protection farmers have about what happens to their data is the contract they sign with the data management company.
These contracts can be relatively complex and involved.
And Indiana lawyer Todd Jansen told the panel, yes, farmers sign contracts all the time.
But now they're being asked to check an I accept box that has some pretty important consequences for what happens to their data, followed by pages and pages of legal type that they may or may not read.
Jansen administers a program in which data companies can go through a process to certify them as being clear with farmers about what the companies can and cannot do with a farmer's data. So far, only 8 companies have been certified. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Dairy industry members and supporters are looking at ways to improve and build upon the margin protection program as a risk management tool. Rod Bain reports.
The 2014 Farm Bill ushered a change in the dairy safety net with the Margin Protection Program. As Jim Mulhern of the National Milk Producers Federation explains,
for a long time, dairy policy in the United States was more focused on a price support level where the government came into the market to buy stocks when we were in surplus to take that product off the market, stabilize price, sell it back into the market when prices began to improve. The Margin Protection Program put into the 2014 Farm Bill was really an introduction of risk management for dairy.
And while many in the dairy industry and industry supporters agree that MPP is the future in the farm safety net, in the present, there needs to be some fine-tuning. Mulhern's colleague at the National Milk Producers Federation, Chris Galen, says, for instance, assumptions such as the premiums and formulas for how milk and feed prices are both calculated are written into the law.
The way that the corn price, the soybean meal price, and the hay price are calculated actually underestimates the cost of buying those things. So it actually overstates how good margins are when feed prices are low. Farmers have worse margins now than what the official USDA calculation is, because when you assign a value to corn, soybean meal, and hay, those are kind of arbitrary. Those were changed by Congress kind of at the last minute when the Farm Bill was created.
A second issue, according to Jim Mulhern, is the price of buying supplemental insurance.
In order to have an effective program, farmers must be able to afford the coverage. And adjusting those premium rates, especially the rates at the lower levels of milk production, will help ensure that MPP provides the safety net coverage that we need for our industry.
And while proposed changes to the Margin Protection Program would mostly occur within the framework of a new farm bill, Chris Galen says some administrative adjustments could be made by the Agriculture Department to improve the program for dairy producers. In fact,
One of the things that Secretary Perdue talked about during his confirmation hearing is, are there other ways that we can construct the MPP to complement the livestock gross margin program and make that more of a complementary tool with MPP?
However, dairy producers currently are only allowed to choose either MPP or LGM coverage, not both.
Our view is that these programs actually can work in a complementary fashion. There may be some other ways you can adjust them so that the LGM can work together in tandem with MPP.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
A report by a Farm Credit Administration economist told the administration's board members last week that the current downturn in the farm economy is not likely to reach a 1980s-style crisis. Farm Credit Chief Economist Stephen Gabriel said the likelihood of this is very low, adding that a confluence of adverse factors led to the crisis that occurred in the 1980s. He says it would take a similar combination of adverse developments to create another farm crisis in the farm economy. While the two periods are similar in some respects, Gabriel points out that interest rates were very high in the 1980s, and today's interest rates are historically low. The price of oil is another major difference, according to his report. In 1979 and 1980, the price surged, while today it is declining. Also, the general economy is in better shape today than it was in the 1980s. The country experienced two recessions in the 1980s crisis, whereas today we're in, quote, extended, if lackluster, economic expansion. That, according to Gabriel. This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm your host, Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Banter Miticide presents Might Banter.
Whoa, would you look at the living space on this almond leaf, Martha?
But you know we'll need to redecorate. The color scheme is very dated.
It's green, honey. It's a leaf.
Don't let mites take up residence in your almond orchard. Knock them down fast with new Banter Miticide from UPI. Banter is formulated to control the most damaging mites and keep them away for weeks. To learn more, contact your PCA or UPI representative today.
Don't let fire ants ruin the value of almond crops. Get long-lasting control of fire ants and other protein-feeding ants with a steam ant bait from Valent. Worker ants carry a steam ant bait back to the queen. Once there, the powerful activity prevents the queen from laying eggs and stops existing larvae from becoming adults. With no new worker ants, the entire colony is effectively wiped out, leaving orchards ant-free for months to come. To learn more, talk to your PCA or go to valent.com/esteemantbait. Always read and follow label instructions.
Get control of flies on your dairy operation with an integrated pest management program built around Clarifly Larvicide and Starbar products from Central Life Sciences. Clarifly Larvicide offers feed-through control that prevents the emergence of nuisance flies from the manure of treated animals by as much as 96%. And Starbar features a lineup of baits, traps, and sprays that address fly problems in all areas of your dairy operation. Flies can spread disease and lead to decreases in milk quality and yields. Learn how to limit their impact at starbarproducts.com. Attention California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. Make plans now to attend the 26th Annual Citrus Expo, August 16th and 17th in Fort Myers, Florida. The latest in citrus research and data, including advances against HLB, will be presented over a dozen seminars. More than 165 exhibitors will be showcasing their newest products, services, and technologies for the citrus industry. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net. That's citrusexpo.net.
I'll take dig a little, learn a lot for 30 bushels.
Soft and crumbly. Tom.
How does healthy soil feel to the touch?
Correct.
Dig a little for 40 bushels.
Sweet and earthy. Tom.
What does healthy soil smell like?
Yes. Go again.
Dig a little for 50 bushels.
Dark, porous, and alive. Tom.
What does healthy soil look like?
You win.
Understanding the basics and benefits of healthy soil can make your farm a winner too, through lower input costs, better yields, and drought protection, which can lead to a healthier bottom line for your business. Contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office today to find out how you can unlock the secrets in your soil. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's Brian German.
the wet winter California experience provided some added benefits to avocado orchards. Overall production in California is down compared to last year, but the rainy winter may help next year's crop rebound in volume. Mary Lou Arpaia is a subtropical horticulturalist for UC Cooperative Extension based out of the Kearney Ag Center. She described the impact all the rainfall had on avocado crops.
Indirectly, it probably helped, especially in Southern California where we have a lot of salinity in the irrigation water and that salt builds up in the soil around the roots. I think all the winter rain probably helped leach salt out of the root zone, and that does help improve the overall health of the tree so that we had a very good bloom in Southern California. But it also impacted the crop that was on the tree that's just been harvested, because that winter rain with the leaching of the salt probably helped in the sizing of the fruit so that we had better fruit sizes.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West.
Ag biotechnology has helped farmers to make both insect pest control and weed management safer while safeguarding crops against disease.
That voice from a 2016 media call on biotechnology legislation belongs to American Soybean Association CEO Steve Senske. Soon he will be sharing his thoughts on ag and farm issues before the Senate Agriculture Committee, nominated Thursday by President Trump for the position of Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, the number two post in USDA. Senske is no stranger to the Agriculture Department, serving in various trade and market development positions during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, culminating with his role as acting administrator of the Foreign Agricultural Service in the early 1990s. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue, in a statement Thursday, says he's extremely pleased with the nomination, citing Senske's experience and leadership skills as an asset to USDA if his nomination is confirmed by the Senate. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Well, in today's livestock news, during the recent Farm Bill listening session held in Florida, support for a foot and mouth disease or FMD vaccine bank was discussed, and we're hearing more and more folks in the livestock industry echoing that very same message. According to a report from Stephanie Ho, Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue says he also supports the idea of a vaccine bank, especially for animal diseases like FMD.
What does the American pork industry want from the next Farm Bill?
The U.S. pork industry's top priority for the next Farm Bill is establishing a foot and mouth disease vaccine bank.
That was David Herring, vice president of the National Pork Producers Council.
If this country ever had an FMD outbreak, it not only could devastate my farm and the whole livestock industry, but the entire U.S. economy. An Iowa State University study estimated that an outbreak, which would immediately shut off our meat exports, would cost the U.S. pork, beef, corn, and soybean sectors $200 billion over 10 years.
His comments came earlier this year at a House Ag Subcommittee hearing.
We want the Farm Bill to direct USDA to contract for an offshore vendor-maintained vaccine bank that would have antigen concentrate to protect against the 23 most common FMD strains currently circulating in the world.
He said there not only needs to be enough vaccine for an immediate response, the industry would like to see that supplies can be ramped up quickly if needed.
A vendor-managed inventory of 10 million doses, which is the estimated need for the first 2 weeks of an outbreak, and an international vaccine manufacturer with the capacity to produce at least 40 million doses.
The pork industry rep appealed for more funding for the issue.
An important element of combating FMD or any foreign animal disease is the ability to monitor and detect disease. That's why we need mandatory increased funding for the National Animal Health Laboratory Network.
At a separate House Ag Committee hearing, USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue told the congressman that he supports the idea of a vaccine bank.
When the mules are out the gate, it's too late to close the gate, so you don't get that opportunity after an outbreak has occurred. So I think you all are wise in considering a vaccine bank, whether it's foot and mouth disease, whether it's high path avian influenza.
He says an outbreak would not only result in actual losses in the short term, but would also mean longer-term psychological damage to the market.
You know what happens whenever we have any of these outbreaks. You go back to BSE almost 15 years ago or longer. That's how long it's taken us to get beef back into some nations there.
One example of U.S. beef making its comeback after suffering under a BSE shadow for more than a dozen years is the recent return of American prime rib to China. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Stephanie. And U.S. beef and pork exports had a strong month of May, increasing significantly from April as well as 2016 levels. USDA statistics compiled by the U.S. Meat Export Federation show pork exports had an 11% increase year over year, while beef exports were up 9%. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Evergreiner is next.
WOTUS. You may never have heard that word, W-O-T-U-S. That's Waters of the United States. It's a program backed by our federal government. It's a word that farmers know well. Just because there's a flowing stream or a natural pond on your property, it doesn't mean you own the water in it. People who use water from these sources are mostly farmers, or used to be. WOTUS put an end to that. There have been lawsuits over the use of water that once belonged to the owner of the land on which it was located. WOTUS is a lot more complicated than I've made it sound, but it looks like it will become even more restrictive than it already is. Farmers hope that the Trump administration will find a way to make WOTUS more farmer-friendly. Well, I'll tell you this, they better not bet their future on it. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
The House Agriculture Committee held a hearing to highlight the importance of technology and innovation in specialty crop production. We've shared with you so far the testimony from California Farm Bureau Federation President Paul Winger and also the CEO of Driscoll's, Kevin Murphy. The President and CEO of the American Seed Trade Association, Andy Levine, testified at the same hearing, and we have for you now his comments.
Thank you, Chairman Conaway, Ranking Member Peterson, and members of the House Agriculture Committee. It's my pleasure to provide this testimony today on behalf of the American Seed Trade Association and our partners in America's land-grant institution and USDA's research community. ASTA's diverse membership consists of over 700 companies involved in seed production, distribution, plant breeding, research, and related industries in North America. As our knowledge of plant genetics and biology has grown, breeders have gained access to new tools, technologies, methods, and strategies to more efficiently address evolving farmer and environmental challenges and to meet ever-changing consumer demand. Today, breeders use an array of tools such as whole genome sequencing, bioinformatics, molecular marker techniques, and digital imaging, which allow them to improve plants more efficiently than ever before. Through evolving and innovative plant breeding methods like gene editing, we can develop new plant varieties without incorporating DNA from outside the plant's family, allowing us to reach the same endpoint as traditional breeding, but in a more precise and targeted manner. Breeders are able to maximize the unique, novel characteristics that are part of a plant's own family. While no gene-edited products are available in the marketplace today, this breeding method, as well as future innovations in plant breeding, represents exciting opportunities for agriculture. This is especially true in the specialty crops arena, where scientists are currently researching gene-editing methods to address costly diseases in crops like citrus, potatoes, grapes, lettuce, and others. Federally funded agricultural research has played an important role in expanding our understanding of plant genetics, leading to new crop varieties, and it's important that the next Farm Bill maintains robust funding for that continued research. USDA investments in gene sequencing of more than 25 agriculturally significant crops, many of those specialty crops, are fundamental to this work. Typically, this research is done in cooperation with partnerships with USDA, universities, and industry researchers. Some of the other examples of research that's ongoing now in the specialty crop arena is the work being performed by Dr. Richard Mitchell Moore at the University of California, Davis, where he's focused on enhancing the efficiency of lettuce production. USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture contributed to his work through the Agriculture and Food Research Initiative, and it is further supported by the Lettuce Genome Sequencing Consortium. The investment by this private sector group, comprised of 10 vegetable seed companies in California, is allowing Mitchell Moore and his team to expand the scope of the project. In 2016, AFRI funded a project at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories in New York, focused on improving growth and yield in tomatoes. Led by Dr. Zach Lippman, researchers isolated genes responsible for characteristics that can diminish yield in tomatoes. By using CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing tools, the team was able to develop tomato plants without those negative characteristics and maintaining the plant's desired characteristics. And at Cornell University, Dr. Thomas Bjorkman is using marker-assisted plant breeding techniques to develop new broccoli varieties that are better suited for production on the East Coast. This initiative is supported by several ASTA member companies and the Farm Bill Specialty Crop Research Initiative. Several varieties have already been developed in this program and have been released to the marketplace. Finally, the Foundation for Food and Agricultural Research, which was authorized in the 2014 Farm Bill, announced just recently the creation of the Crops for Future Collaborative Research Initiative with 8 partners. This project will leverage a $10 million federal investment in pre-competitive research to hasten yield and nutrition gains in leafy greens, wheat, and corn. It's clear that research in modern plant breeding requires sustained and long-term funding for ARS and for our academic community through the NIFA programs. However, the promise of these research investments will only be fully realized if federal policies foster a climate of continued innovation. Overly burdensome policies around gene editing and other evolving plant breeding methods would likely limit their use to large row crops and preclude smaller companies and public sector researchers from benefiting from the use of these methods. We urge Congress to encourage USDA, FDA, and EPA to have consistent science-based policies that promote innovation so that everyone can benefit from emerging innovations like gene editing in our future plant breeding techniques. In addition to domestic efforts, it's important that the U.S. government develops an international engagement strategy to communicate with our trading partners in order to prevent trade barriers due to non-harmonized regulations. Mr. Chairman, member of the committees, this is truly a monumental time for the plant breeding sciences, monumental time for the plant sciences, and it is our hope that the administration, Congress, the research community, and the public at large have the opportunity to benefit from the knowledge and breeding methods that have been evolving since before the time of Gregor Mendel. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I look forward to answering any questions.
Again, President and CEO of the American Seed Trade Association, Andy Levine, testifying before the House Agriculture Committee hearing to highlight the importance of technology and innovation in specialty crop production. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Banter Miticide presents Might Banter.
Oh, would you look at the living space on this almond leaf, Martha?
But you know we'll need to redecorate. The color scheme is very dated.
It's green, honey. It's a leaf.
Don't let mites take up residence in your almond orchard. Knock them down fast with new Banter Miticide from UPI. Banter is formulated to control the most damaging mites and keep them away for weeks. To learn more, contact your PCA or UPI representative today.
Don't let fire ants ruin the value of almond crops. Get long-lasting control of fire ants and other protein-feeding ants with a steam ant bait from Valent. Worker ants carry a steam ant bait back to the queen. Once there, the powerful activity prevents the queen from laying eggs and stops existing larvae from becoming adults. With no new worker ants, the entire colony is effectively wiped out, leaving orchards ant-free for months to come. To learn more, talk to your PCA or go to valent.com/esteemantbait. Always read and follow label instructions.
Get control of flies on your dairy operation with an integrated pest management program built around Clarifly Larvicide and Starbar products from Central Life Sciences. Clarifly Larvicide offers feed-through control that prevents the emergence of nuisance flies from the manure of treated animals by as much as 96%. And Starbar features a lineup of baits, traps, and sprays that address fly problems in all areas of your dairy operation. Flies can spread disease and lead to decreases in milk quality and yields. Learn how to limit their impact at starbarproducts.com. Attention California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. Make plans now to attend the 26th Annual Citrus Expo, August 16th and 17th in Fort Myers, Florida. The latest in citrus research and data, including advances against HLB, will be presented over a dozen seminars. More than 165 exhibitors will be showcasing their newest products, services, and technologies for the citrus industry. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net. That's citrusexpo.net.
I'll take dig a little, learn a lot for 30 bushels.
Soft and crumbly. Tom.
How does healthy soil feel to the touch?
Correct.
Dig a little for 40 bushels.
Sweet and earthy. Tom.
What does healthy soil smell like?
Yes. Go again.
Dig a little for 50 bushels.
Dark, porous, and alive. Tom.
What does healthy soil look like?
You win.
Understanding the basics and benefits of healthy soil can make your farm a winner too, through lower input costs, better yields, and drought protection, which can lead to a healthier bottom line for your business. Contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office today to find out how you can unlock the secrets in your soil. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. And now more of the agriculture stories you'll want to know today. Per person, U.S. consumption of blueberries is up from less than a tenth of a pound in 1990 to over a pound and a half today. Gary Crawford has more.
And now, we're at the farmer's market. We got stuff we gotta say about a great food we are discussing.
Yeah, it's blueberries today.
That's Laura Popilski talking blueberry to every girl and boy. She says you can bake it in a cupcake or
slap it in a bowl and enjoy.
That's the blueberry blues, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's enough of that. Laura and I are indeed out here at the Agriculture Department's Farmers Market in Washington. Laura's telling people all about blueberries because it is what?
National Blueberry Month.
Yes. Now, Laura, you say these things may be small, but what?
They're powerful little berries. Blueberries are a source of vitamin K, which is good for blood health.
Yeah.
Vitamin C, which is good for your immune system and healing and iron absorption. And lastly, blueberries are a source of antioxidants.
No, not antioxidants, antioxidants, some of which have been connected to, you know, helping prevent certain chronic diseases. Now, unlike some fruits and berries that don't ripen after they're picked.
Blueberries will ripen a little bit after you pick them. They will get a little softer and juicier, but they might not get much sweeter.
Now, Laura, you talked about the raspberries last time, said they were delicate, injured easily, and that sort of thing. What about blueberries?
Blueberries are a lot tougher than raspberries.
And you say they've got a longer shelf life, that is, if the shelf is, what, in the refrigerator, right?
Blueberries you'll want to store in the refrigerator in the container you purchased them in for about 10 days, but you do not want to rinse them until you're about to eat them.
Oh, now, why is that?
Oh, because when you expose fruits and vegetables to water, that gives them much more opportunity to go bad quicker, get moldy.
Now, we just had the 4th of July, so many of us may still be in that patriotic mode. So, Laura, you've got a recipe for something to go right along with that.
Red, white, and blueberry. Blueberry salad. Cherry tomatoes, blueberries, mozzarella in the balls, or you can cut it into bite-sized pieces, basil, and then a vinaigrette of balsamic vinegar, olive oil, and salt and pepper. Super simple. That's your red, white, and blue salad right there.
Yeah, you described making that salad the same way that many people describe me.
Super simple.
Yeah, right. Well, for lots of interesting ways to use blueberries, go online to What's Cooking USDA, What's Cooking USDA. So, Laura says if you go out, get those blueberries for you, you won't get those blueberry blues. Well, that's all for today. Gary Crawford for the USDA. Yeah.
Therapists are seeing that interaction with horses has value for people with a wide range of serious medical challenges. Stephanie Ho has more on the story.
Don't have any preconceived notions because there'll be limitations.
This kind of useful self-help advice applies to life in general, but certified therapeutic horseback riding instructor Nikki Beveridge is talking about something more specific.
It's particularly empowering to work with a horse because you begin with an animal that just simply physically is very big. They're easily 1,000 pounds or more.
She works with horses and people who have disabilities, including multiple sclerosis, cerebral palsy, deafness, blindness, and ADHD.
If you have a significant disability, then you tend to go through life noticing that other people can do certain things much more easily than you.
Which is the basic reason why she believes therapeutic horseback riding works.
When you're put in a position where you get to surprise yourself, where you look and your first thought is, this is not something that I can do. And it ends up being something you absolutely can do and you can get better at and that you often can shine at. that's obviously something that makes you feel very good.
Besides helping strengthen self-esteem and self-confidence, therapeutic horseback riding also has other tangible benefits.
When we look at the way a human's pelvis moves when they're sitting on the back of a horse, the horse's walk produces human pelvic movement that's nearly identical to the human walk if they were just using their own 2 feet.
Erica Berg is an associate professor of equine studies at North Dakota State University. She says riders also get help with motor planning skills.
So when we get on the back of a horse, we have to do things in a certain order, or you end up backwards, or you end up maybe, you know, on the ground. And so it's really important that we have a similar sequence of movements that we use. We put our foot in the stirrup, we put our hands on the horse's neck, we swing our leg over the back, we sit gently on the horse.
Therapeutic horseback riding traces its origins back 65 years ago to a disabled heroine and her horse, Jubilee.
The 1952 Olympics opened in Helsinki, Finland. As yesteryear,
there was a dressage Olympian by the name of Liz Hartel, and she was from Denmark, and she was partially paralyzed by polio in her early 20s.
Although Hartel was a skilled horseback rider before she was stricken with polio, her doctors told her she would never ride again.
And what ended up happening was she proved them all very wrong, and she actually won a silver medal in the sport of dressage.
This was the first time a woman won an equestrian Olympic medal. Many people didn't even realize that Hartel had polio.
Until she walked up to the podium to get her medal, and she did so with a very significant limp.
Burke says one major organization that has grown out of this is the Professional Association of Therapeutic Horsemanship, or PATH International. She herself is a PATH instructor and says there are nearly 900 accredited PATH centers around the world, or more than double than when she first started nearly 20 years ago. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at agnetwest or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.